Just one more song. This is Mice and Scene off the album Desires Despair. Here it goes, Our Desire, which is played. The song name is called Desire. Here it goes, folks. DJ Abraham signing off.
Instructors for a course here at UBC called LFS 400. It's a course in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems that has agriculture students learn how to create radio documentaries, audio stories, podcasts, that kind of stuff. So for the next hour or so, we're going to listen to a whole bunch of different stories created by UBC students playing it as a part of 24 hours of student power, or 22 hours of student power, however it is. Anyways, I hope you enjoy them. Thank you.
Behind the Macmillan Building, the Faculty of Land and Food Systems cultivates a humble plot of land called the Orchard Garden. Planted and harvested entirely by UBC students, the garden provides an abundant supply of vegetables for the student-run Agora Cafe. I went to the garden to visit Emma and Heather, who were busy turning compost.
So what are we seeing here, or what are we looking at, rather?
Oh, a pile of semi-decomposed compost. There's some horse manure and some corn stalks and lots of hay around.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's going to turn into just
see some really big
goodness for the
big
garden.
Worms there.
Yeah, some really big worms.
So with the compost, you put it on the garden and...
Yeah, you amend the soil with the compost. It adds organic matter to the soil and lots of delicious nutrients for the plants.
They both told me that the garden played an important role in their schooling, both as a community space where they could work with dozens of other students and as an academic space where they can experience hands-on learning.
We're learning about agriculture and but we learn about it like from books and in classrooms, and this is a hands-on way to like learn like practical skills like composting, like nutrient cycling. Like you can read all you want about it in a textbook, but like it's way different to come out here and like turn a big pile of horse manure, right?
However, the university has plans that could destroy the garden in order to build a mixed-use student housing development. Neither Emma nor Heather were sure when or why this was happening.
I don't know. I have not spoken with them nor gotten a sense for what their planning process is. I don't know if I can speak to their attitude yet.
We haven't been consulted at all. Like, I don't even know what the campus planning people look like. They're just kind of this like invisible looming force that's like threatening our space. We don't really know anything about them.
Faceless.
This is Joe Stott, the face of UBC's Campus and Community Planning Office, otherwise known as CNCP. I met with him at the CITR studios.
Right from the get-go, the Orchard Gardens was... there's lots of documentation to show that it was meant to be temporary and there would be no fuss when it came time for the land to be used for something else.
Joe went on to tell me a little bit more about the unique history of the space. It was originally covered by raccoon-infested trailers, but professors in the faculties of education and land and food systems asked that they be given permission to convert the land into a garden. CNCP agreed, but only gave them a temporary permit, because they would eventually use the land as a development site. This is Murray Eisman, the Dean of Land and Food Systems.
We were under no illusions that this was going to be a permanent site at all. We expected that eventually the university would choose to build on it, and of course, when the university produced its most recent official campus plan in 2011, it shows that that's where one of these new multipurpose hubs is going to be.
I sat down with Professor Susan Jarofsky to ask her about how she felt about CNCP's plans.
So I won't say I'm surprised, but I am dismayed.
Susan is a professor at the Faculty of Education. She was worried that CNCP might not appreciate the full value of the garden.
It always seems to me that the university is sometimes, you know, is working at cross purposes with itself, because place and promise, the university plan, is all about sustainability, indigeneity, making the greenest campus and the greenest city, and so on. And then there's the arm of the university that wants to build buildings and make money on real estate and so on. And it seems to be a very different ethos.
Susan thinks that campus planners are well-intentioned. They're just disconnected.
So I think that those people are fine people, but they don't... I think when they look at the Orchard Garden, they don't see this wealth of pedagogy and research and a culture that's important to the university. They just see what looks like a little bit of a messy garden space that maybe they should plant a bunch of shrubs around the edges and just make it tidy it up because it's so messy.
Anytime a planning issue comes up at UBC, it seems to become a heated, highly politicized event. In my 4 years here, I can recall at least 3 or 4 high-profile disputes between students and the university. I wondered if this would become one of those, so I went to the student who knows more about campus planning than perhaps anyone I know, and asked him why these issues get people so worked up.
Basically just because I think they're trying to ram it in places where it doesn't necessarily belong.
This is Neil Janssen.
I used to write for a campus news blog called UBC Insiders, and I'm a PhD student in chemistry, and I've been on campus since 2006.
Neil is a dogged investigative journalist. Before we even sat down, he told me about a story he was working on in which he uncovered that the university took a $3.5 million donation from a real estate developer and then bent their own planning rules to accommodate for a development on South Campus. We spoke about the recent history of campus land disputes, from the plans to put housing on the UBC farm to the Gate South issue, where the university sought to build market developments at the heart of campus.
So I want to shift to the Orchard Garden and ask you what about this story is analogous to your experience and what isn't exactly. But first, the one thing that struck me, I was there a couple days ago, and speaking to the people that work there and have for years, and I asked them about campus community planning, and they said it just feels like this faceless force that I don't know what's going on, but they just want to destroy my garden.
That wouldn't be the first person to have that impression.
Is there any way to find out, really? Like, is it a matter of them not being transparent, or is it just a matter of us being disconnected from them?
I think they're not that bad for transparency. There's certainly improvements to be made, and they are getting better, but it's just a matter of, it's hard to know. It's easy to know what decisions they make and who's involved, but it's hard to know why this decision was made. And oftentimes the problem is that a lot of people don't realize the decisions have been made until after the fact. So the idea to put Orchard Commons there was made in 2009, which is a whole cohort of students ago. And so even if that had been an issue then, students that have come any time since 2009 wouldn't know that that is the case.
Joe told me that the consultation process is quite rigorous. Community voices and student voices matter. However, this is rather unique. At UBC, the landowner and the regulator are one and the same. UBC's board approves developments, and CNCP administers those decisions. Whereas in typical jurisdiction, you would have to seek approval from another body, say, your municipal council. I asked Joe to tell me more about governance and consultation, and he told me that there is a minister that does provide oversight.
The minister expects the university to have exactly the same kind of consultation that any municipality would have before they would pass an official community plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's not actually rigorous, right? There, we've had six ministers in the last 3 years or something like that. I spoke to the minister and asked him how he feels being in charge of development here, and he didn't really have any idea that he was. Because he's the minister of other things too, and UBC is just a blip on that radar. And so there isn't any actual oversight as far as anyone can tell. Nothing has gone into the ministry and come out in any way changed.
The Orchard Commons development is a little bit different from the land disputes that Neil worked on so closely. Gage South, the farm, and University Boulevard were all areas that the university wanted to lease for market housing. The Commons is a university-financed development and built exclusively for students. However, like these past cases, it too seems to be at least somewhat motivated by financial gain. Orchard Commons will most likely house beds and classrooms for a boutique program called Bridge to UBC, which would charge underqualified international students a premium tuition for a program that would promise to bridge them into general admission. The university is expecting the program to turn substantial profits by 2016. I asked Neil if he thought this was a part of their decision-making process.
Of course, they're making money off of it. But that's nothing new for international student programs. International students have long been viewed as not only sources of income, but they are sources of income, and that's pretty well established at this point, and no one seems to have much problem with it.
I invited UBC's VP Finance onto the program to respond, but he declined my invitation. I also spoke with Kieran Mahal, the AMS's Vice President Academic, and she agreed that Bridge was partly financially motivated. When I asked her if the university had discussed the details of the program with her, she said that they hadn't, except on an abstract level. This all seemed quite rushed to me. The program is just around the corner, poised to take 300 students by 2014 and 1,000 by 2016. It even seems that Bridge may have played a role in fast-tracking the Orchard Commons project. Again, Susan.
And originally, this building was scheduled for build completion starting in 2020, so it would have given us a lot more years to work together to try to figure things out. But it was suddenly fast-tracked, and now it's supposed to be the summer of 2014 when they dig the hole in the ground.
This isn't unusual. As Neil told me, UBC does tend to move very fast with their development plans.
Again, history is interesting to go into the more you look into it, and the fact that they held an emergency board of governors meeting to change the land use plan less than 24 hours after the bill that gave them the power was given royal assent. So they held an emergency board meeting less than 24 hours after that happened to get the process rolling. So obviously they weren't wasting any time with their newfound powers.
Ever since that day, UBC has been aggressively developing nearly every part of campus.
Well, I think they recognize that they only have one real shot at it. So I think they're trying to responsibly maximize what they can do in terms of being able to house as many people as possible, bring in as much revenue as possible, while still doing it in a responsible and reasonable way. And where responsible and reasonable lies seems to be the issue, that is under disagreement most of the time.
It does seem that campus planners are supportive of the garden, partly because they see the garden itself as a potential amenity for the Orchard Commons. Murray, Joe, and Susan were all very optimistic. Joe and Murray even suggested that there may be room to put a temporary garden in another location, at a place called Totem Field. This would give students an opportunity to work while the construction was underway. However, Susan has her reservations. Susan told me that there would have to be substantial investments of time and energy to make any plot of soil suitable. There are other important considerations too, like drainage, access to light, and importantly, walking distance. 500 students from the Faculty of Education use the Orchard Garden for their classes, and Susan claimed that the additional walk to Totem Field would likely be too far. At the Orchard Garden, Emma and Heather told me many of the same things. Heather mentioned that some students were talking about occupying the Orchard Garden, but most thought that there could be a productive conversation instead. Neil suggested that they don't have much in the way of bargaining power, given the temporary permit, but they should still be vigilant.
If that was the deal, then that was the deal. And it might just be a matter of timing that they're too early in the planning process for Orchard. That campus community planning doesn't want to and can't make promises that it will be relocated somewhere because it's just too early to say what it will look like. They don't know what the buildings will look like. They don't know what the landscape will look like. Just try to push them and be in constant contact. And that's all you can do. And
just to make sure they keep it a priority.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how this story will end. It might end well, but I think there's still a troubling lesson here. Students and faculty don't really feel like they're guiding the process. That's why planning issues have been so heated, like the UBC Farm or Gage South. The garden may not become that, but so far it has followed a similar script. Administrators have had a plan for several years, students weren't meaningfully consulted with, and now they're surprised. From my perspective, UBC is fast-tracking the Orchard Commons because they are under financial pressures. They are looking to make windfall profits by attracting more international students through the Bridge program. The garden may stay as an amenity, but that seems like almost an afterthought. I may be wrong, but no one has taken the trouble of telling me otherwise. And more importantly, no one has taken the trouble of telling the students at the garden otherwise. Heather and Emma don't seem to care much for UBC's broad institutional imperatives. They haven't really been included in that conversation. They just hope to keep using the garden to learn more about food production.
And is this the kale?
This? This is the collard greens?
Okay.
Same family as kale. Brassica family.
Cool. It's a testament to how removed most people are from the food system, because I have no clue what this even is, really.
Not uncommon.
It's a shame.
Brassicas, they all look essentially the same when they're little itty bitties.
Brassicas, this blows my mind. Brassicas are all the same species. They're the same type of plant that's just been cultivated for different parts. Like broccoli, you eat the flowers, and kale, you eat the leaves, and turnips, you eat the roots, but it's all the same species of plant. Which is crazy.
Where if I see a worm outside of that bin, I will throw it off the balcony.
Such was my sister's reaction when I told her we were getting a worm composting bin for our house, or more specifically, our living room. Needless to say, she was not impressed.
I feel like warmth plus rotten fruit plus creatures equals disgust. That's what I feel. Like that... That is the perfect situation where the worms escape and attack because they're unhappy. Also, the smell attracting flies.
My sister's horrified reaction towards this project was not surprising, given that I would be bringing worms into our home. But come 2015, Metro Vancouver will be banning all organic materials, including food scraps from the landfills, as part of their effort to reduce the equivalent weight in waste of almost 8.5 Empire State Buildings that Metro Vancouver produces every year. One suggestion for dealing with organic waste is vermicomposting, which is the process of recycling organic waste by feeding it to worms who then turn that waste into compost. So, my experiment will be to put a vermicompost in my apartment to see if it is a feasible option for reducing my family's waste. My only opposition? My sister, who is convinced that the worms will escape, that the compost will smell, and that Vancouver's ban on organic materials is one of the worst ideas she's ever heard. So in 2015, Vancouver will be banning all of its organic waste from landfills. So you can't put in any food scraps, you can't put any food scrapings in the garbage, any meat, any raw food products like vegetables and fruits. None of that from anywhere in Vancouver can go into the landfill anymore or into any of their waste facilities.
I feel like nobody knows about this. I've never heard about this before, and I think it's stupid.
Why do you feel this way? You seem to be very aggravated about this.
Like, what are you supposed to do with the food then? Why can't it just decompose in a landfill? Nobody's gonna do that. Nobody even recycles. Hell, I only recycle because of your judgmental gaze, okay?
So by sending organic waste to the landfill, we're actually producing more greenhouse gases. Because when it's trapped in a plastic bag, anaerobic decomposition happens. So what that means is that the bacteria that are breaking down the food in a non-oxygen environment, because it's stuck in a closed bag, produce methane. So this is one of the reasons why they're doing this, and also because you can divert some of that waste and then produce fertilizer in your own home.
So you really think 2.5 million people, most of which don't recycle, let's be honest here, are really going to go out and get a bin full of worms and put it in their home and start scraping off their food scrapings?
So worm compost isn't the only version of compost that you can use, but worm compost is good especially for apartment dwellers who have limited space. In apartments, it's a little bit more challenging. So that's why I'm looking into a worm compost bin. So what are your initial thoughts on this worm compost bin now, especially that you know about the ban? I know you originally thought I just wanted them as pets.
The worm compost is probably the worst idea you've ever had, and you've had a few bad ones.
Why is it a bad idea?
Because you're bringing creatures into our house that will likely escape and attack me, and I don't want that to happen.
So possibly those fears could be completely unfounded. The chances of a worm attack are quite limited. Despite my sister's complete lack of enthusiasm, we were getting a worm compost. So, the following Saturday, I did a vermicomposting workshop offered by the City of Vancouver and took home a brand new worm bin. I also checked in with Emma, the vermicomposting coordinator in the UBC sub, who offered to take me down into the depths of the sub to see her healthy worm bin, and also to get some tips on managing my own. Where are we? I'm in the tunnels of the sub.
We're not in the most beautiful location just because, you know, this project came in considerably later than other things. So we kind of got relegated into the corner of this room.
Okay.
It's not the prettiest place, but...
This is huge.
So this is called a worm wigwam.
A worm wigwam.
Yeah, we bought it from a supplier in Oregon.
I got half a pound of worms for my little worm composter at home.
Yeah.
So this is a much bigger...
We started with 10 and 10...
10 pounds.
10 pounds of worms sort of was sitting in a substrate with a depth of maybe 6 or 8 inches.
Okay.
So I presume there's a lot more than 10 pounds of worms now in this bin.
This is crazy.
So they're moving. You can see that they're healthy because they're wriggling around.
Yeah, and it doesn't really smell at all.
Nope.
That's crazy. So three of my sister's main fears are worm attacks...
Worm attacks.
Yes. She's afraid that they'll leave the bin, that they'll escape. That's the second one. And the third one is that the compost will smell.
Okay. Yeah, it shouldn't smell, especially if you're burying it properly and you're adding paper, right? So you have to add a lot of paper. And you make sure that the balance is right. So it's mostly balancing out. The two things that you're putting in are food scraps and paper. So if you balance out those two volumes, you should have a nice mix, which will not produce smell. So... In an aerated system, like this one, the worms are doing the aeration for you.
Mm-hmm.
In an aerated system, you should not have any unpleasant odors.
Okay.
It's typically only in an anaerobic environment that you will have foul odors because of the bacteria that are involved in anaerobic processes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they're producing... This is basically all worm poo.
Yeah, right? Awesome. Yeah, so this is huge compared to the thing I have at home. But it's really good to see. Like, this is what a successful worm bin looks like.
So if you want to keep fruit flies away for sure, what I would do is bury it into the actual substrate itself.
Okay.
And then you can put your bedding on top.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was now armed with tips on how to keep a healthy worm bin. But could I convince my sister of this as well? A week later, it was time to feed the worms, and I volunteered my sister for the job to see if I could change her mind. It's been a week since we got our worm compost, so come on over, Jillian. I've got a liter of food for this week, so if you want to come on over
this
here.
You need to
come towards the compost. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So, can you describe what you're seeing right now? You haven't actually opened the box yet.
An ugly-ass box sitting in the middle of our living room with a suspiciously happy-looking worm sticker on the side.
Interesting. Okay, that's a good first impression. So, I noticed right away you're plugging your nose, you're expecting... No, this is really interesting.
No.
So, I haven't even opened the lid, and right now you're already covering your nose and you're expecting it to really smell.
I don't want to look at them.
So, what is, when I open the box, what do you expect to see?
It's, like, massive worms just kind of wriggling around.
Okay. All right, let's open the
box. Don't do it.
Let's open the box.
I don't want to look at it.
So, let's...
Where are the worms? Oh, it smells! It smells like farm...
You first said something, though, when I opened the box. What did you say?
Where are the worms?
Right. Interesting. So not at all what you were expecting.
Have they escaped? Are they in my bed? Why are you touching it? Shouldn't you wear gloves?
No, it's fine. What else can you smell?
It's not unpleasant.
Is earthy a good way to describe it? Like, it smells like...
I guess so.
Like a forest, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not actually that bad.
There was a lot more food when I initially...
What is that?
That's lettuce. Do you see this hole? That was not there when I... Like, this has been definitely well eaten.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, this was quite full. There's hole... And see... Do you see all those black things on there?
Yeah, what is that?
Those are worm castings, so it's called... That's basically...
That poo? Is that worm... That's worm poo. That's a nice, sciencey way of saying worm poo.
Have you seen a worm yet?
Yeah, where are they? That does smell like a forest.
I know no one can see this right now, but she's actually touching the bedding.
Don't, no, you found one. Yeah. I hate how they move so much. Looking for prey.
So, now that we've seen the compost, what are your thoughts? This is our first week in.
And I guess it doesn't smell the way I thought it would. That does not to say that I enjoy the smell. The rotten food still throws me off a little bit.
Do you still think that this is the worst idea I've ever had?
Well, it's not the best idea you've ever had, but it's not the worst either, I guess.
Progress. We are making progress. We are changing attitudes.
So how afraid are you of worm attacks after this meeting?
I guess not as afraid.
That smirk off your face.
There's no smirk. This is just, like, really cool that I didn't actually expect that that you'd be as interested in this as you are right now. And you even touched the bedding, which is a very cool thing.
This won't be an ongoing thing. This is your project still.
Yeah. It's just you're a little bit more accepting of it now,
I guess.
Almost 2 weeks later, and the worm bin is still doing well. And my sister has helped me check on it once more. In less than 2 years, Metro Vancouver will be implementing their ban on organic waste. And part of me wonders how many people would be more open to it if they knew that compost can be well managed and easily taken care of. The vermicomposting workshop I took was completely full, so hopefully that is a clear sign that attitudes are beginning to change. Either way, I've managed to partially change my sister's attitude, which I mark down as a huge accomplishment. Reporting for LFS 400, I'm Nicole Reed. Thanks for listening.
So you're listening to me right now as I'm standing behind my neighborhood grocery store. I was curious to see if I could find anything interesting in their dumpsters, and right now I'm standing in front of a green dumpster labeled organic, so I guess let's take a look. Huh, there's a lot of food in here. It's mostly old lettuce leaves, which I wouldn't take, but there's some good-looking food in here. I see some carrots, there's some chard, there's some radishes, and it all looks like you'd be alright to eat. Today's program is dedicated to the food that ends up in the garbage can. We'll meet someone who eats it, we'll try and figure out where it comes from, and we'll see if there's anything that can be done about it. Jen and her partner Grant have stopped shopping for food like ordinary people.
I don't just stop by the grocery store on my way home from work anymore. It's more like we'll go on a Saturday evening around 11 p.m. And drive around the industrial areas and look for food that way. It's not my favorite way to shop, to tell you the truth. I don't advocate it at all.
For 12 months, they've decided to only eat food that would otherwise be thrown in the garbage. And they're filming it and turning it into a documentary. And they're not just eating food that they find in dumpsters. Jen and Grant have been saving food from being thrown out in lots of different ways. Recently, they have been buying it by the pallet from wholesalers.
You get a lot of one type of thing at a time, so that's been a challenge for us because we're trying to balance having a good variety in our diet. And then the other place that we go is right inside the grocery store. We'll ask them if they're culling food off the tray, if we can buy that food. So, like, there's really nothing wrong with it. It's just close to its date, or it's a little bit imperfect, or it already has a bruise and they know people won't pick it. Then we'll buy that.
For Jen, her mission to eat food that would otherwise go in the garbage is not about saving money. They aren't freegans or people who only eat free food. And their diet isn't meant to be any kind of political statement. They're just regular people who were worried about how much food they waste.
My partner and I, like, we're working professionals. We're in our 30s. I wear heels at my office at work. Like, we're not doing it for any kind of, like, economic reasons, but it's more about raising awareness.
The truth is, in North America, we waste a lot of food.
Approximately 40% is wasted along the entire food chain, and about half of that, so 25% of total food waste, is individuals. So at the consumer level, like when you're buying your groceries, it's like buying your groceries and then taking them home and then throwing one third of them away, basically.
In North America, we throw away 29 million tons of food a year. That's enough to fill a football stadium-sized cereal bowl up with food once every 3 days. The average person throws away a half a pound of food a day. That's like throwing away a quarter pound cheeseburger at lunch and then doing it again at dinner. Clearly, we have a food waste problem. But why?
Well, cheap food, of course.
That's Jim Verkaman. He's a professor of economics at the University of British Columbia.
I think relative to our disposable income, we're maybe paying 15% or less of our income on food.
Food is cheap and widely available. Who cares if a bundle of celery in the refrigerator goes limp when you can buy another for a dollar at the grocery store? And because food is so cheap, it's also cheap to throw away. But how can food be so inexpensive? It's because we don't have to pay what economists call external costs. External costs are costs associated with making something that aren't reflected in its price. And because we don't have to pay them, we don't even think about them.
You don't think about the externality costs, like the landfill costs, the CO2 emissions from disposing of that food, the water alone that went into that food, you know, thousands and thousands of liters of water in one serving of food that you wasted, and that's impacting, therefore, the capacity to produce food in other parts of the country, your capacity to sell food to other countries. You just don't internalize that externality.
So it's hard to understand how much producing and disposing of our food really costs. As individuals, this is great. It keeps our food cheap. But as a society, it's not so great. Those externalized costs don't just go away. Eventually, somebody has to pay for them. And there's another side to this story. It's that food I saw in the dumpster. Why would a grocery store throw away its food?
Businesses waste a lot of food because it's economically rational for them to waste food, and it's not rational for society to waste food, but from a business owner, I guess you want to let consumers have lots of choice. So if you have apples on display, you know that consumers like to pick out the nice perfect apples and leave behind the not so perfect ones. So you let consumers pick out the good ones, and the leftover ones, they don't look so good, and you basically throw it away.
People like to get the best stuff. We like to feel like we get the best value for our money. Walk down a produce aisle and you'll see people squeezing and smelling fruits and vegetables as they attempt to find the best ones. It's just how people shop for groceries. So it makes sense for a business to throw away the bruised and imperfect stuff, because nobody's ever going to choose it. And there's another reason. Businesses never want to run out of food on the shelves, so they buy more than they actually need.
You never want to run out of stuff, because if it costs you, say, 50 cents to buy a head of lettuce, and you can sell it for $1.50, if you run out of something, you've just lost a dollar margin. But if you waste something, you've only wasted 50 cents. So it's economically rational to waste in that sense.
In a way, we benefit from grocery stores throwing away food. Throwing away food allows us to shop at stores where the shelves are always stocked and the food always looks great. But wasting food also has its disadvantages. We pay a little bit more for our food to cover the cost of what stores throw in the garbage. And there are those external costs. So I asked our economist, why is it so hard to stop wasting food? A lot of people would agree that wasting food is a bad thing, but so few people choose to do anything about it. Why is it so hard to bridge that gap between caring and doing something?
Given what everybody else is doing, I have an incentive to deviate. I have an incentive to free ride on the system. I have an incentive to pick out the very best produce and leave the yuckier stuff behind for someone else. So if we all act in our self-interest, we don't internalize the impact it has on other shoppers or on the landfill or on CO2 emissions, that even though we care as a society, individually our self-interest leads the market to fail.
It's because we all assume that somebody else is going to deal with it. As long as food is cheap and we act in our self-interest, food will be wasted. I was a little bit disappointed after talking to Jim, so I asked my food waste guru, Jen, what I could do in my own small way to reduce food waste.
The first one is to meal plan. Think about what you're going to eat and then only buy the ingredients you need for those recipes, and then try to make one recipe go into the next recipe. So if you have leftover pasta from one meal, maybe you can put it into soup for the next meal so that each meal isn't just a separate thing. And then the second thing I think is to buy imperfect food. If you're picking apples, I try to make myself now pick the first apple that I touch at the store. Like, it made it all the way to the store. Why not buy it? Like, who cares if there's a little bit of a bruise in it, you know? It's just a small imperfection. And so to buy those imperfect things, if we all did that, I think that would make a big difference.
And for that food that just has to be thrown away, she gave me this piece of advice.
At least we should be composting all of our food waste so that it's not going in the landfill. And that's not just individuals, that's like grocery stores and restaurants. Like, everybody needs to be composting.
Once you start looking for it, Food is wasted everywhere. Look in your fridge, the dumpster behind your neighborhood grocery store, your garbage can, your neighbor's garbage can, your friend's counter after a potluck, the food table after a catered event, the trunk of your car, the produce aisle at the grocery store, behind your fridge, at the bottom of your bag, in your pockets. You'll probably find something that is, or once was, good to eat. And where there is food waste, there's the opportunity to do the right thing. So, whether it is a little bit past its prime, or scratched, or bruised, just eat it.
I guess I've been bruised, if we were to speak plain. Every bruise that comes to flesh makes its mark on the brain.
For more information on Jen and her food waste mission, go to foodwastemovie.com.
I grew up on the outskirts of Winnipeg. My father hunted, my family hunted. At about probably 8 or 10 years of age, I ran a trap line. I went out, basically snared, trapped, shot rabbits, brought them home. My mom cooked them. We grew up, we had a chicken house. The early realization was if you wanted to eat a chicken had to die. And the reality was somebody had to kill it. So what we've got now is a situation where most people don't relate the animal to the meat. We get people who think that meat comes in plastic packages and no animals were harmed during this process. The reality is that, it happens. And if you want to eat meat, or I guess even if you want to eat a vegetable, something has to die.
That voice? That's Marshall Owen. Marshall taught me firearm safety and hunting education. He's great. He has a lifetime of experience and a deep, thoughtful connection with hunting. But from my voice, you might be asking, why does she want to hunt? And you're right, I don't really match the demographic. I'm a 20-something university student. I live in Vancouver. I grew up in the suburbs. I was the only girl present the day I wrote the firearm safety exam. When I started this project, I had never killed an animal. That's changed now, and you'll hear about it a little later. I'm telling you up front because I don't think it's fair to spring that on someone in the middle of a podcast. But I'll also tell you that it's fine. It wasn't traumatic for me or for the animal or for anyone involved. I'm interested in the disconnect that Marshall was talking about, how we don't relate the meat to the animal. So many of us consume meat without any thought towards the life that gave it. I want to eat meat, but I want to be connected to where it comes from. And most of the meat produced on this planet comes from a pretty bleak place.
Most Canadians and Americans eat about, or at least you could say, half a pound of meat a day, which is far more than the planet seems to be able to produce ecologically and far more than seems to be good for our health.
This is Dr. Eleanor Boyle. She's a Vancouver-based teacher, researcher, and writer, and the author of the recently published book, High Stakes: Why and How to Eat Less Meat.
The ways that we're producing livestock now add significantly to climate change, are an enormous contributor to water pollution, use inordinate amounts of land and scarce fresh water, and contribute to all kinds of public health issues, chief among these antibiotic resistance, but many others as well.
So industrial meat production, it's bad. It's really, really bad. There are about 25 billion livestock animals currently on the earth. That's more than 3 for every single human being. About 1/3 of the arable land on this planet is dedicated to growing feed for these animals. Much of that land could grow food crops for humans, and most is treated with synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, which are allowed to pollute our atmosphere and water systems. The amount of fresh water that goes into raising an animal for meat is mind-blowing. It takes over 15,000 liters of fresh water to produce 1 kilogram of beef. That's 9 Olympic-sized swimming pools for every cow. Animals produce manure, which can be an important source of nutrients for plant crops, but is being produced in such great quantities that it contributes greatly to greenhouse gas production and seeps into our waterways. Living conditions are cramped and unclean, so animals are pumped full of antibiotics to keep them alive. Then they're killed, carelessly and imprecisely. Like I say, it's bad, but what does it do for us? Why do we eat it?
Meat does make important contributions to a person's dietary intake if they choose to eat meat, but you can completely exclude meat for an entire lifetime and more than adequately meet your nutrient needs.
Dr. Candice Rideout is a nutritionist and instructor in the Food, Nutrition, and Health program at the University of British Columbia.
Iron is an important micronutrient that is provided by meat, which is animal tissue or animal muscle. It is a good source of protein, and that tends to be what people identify with meat the most. Although, ironically, in terms of proportion of calories coming from protein, meat is really no different from anything else, including broccoli, for example, which provides more than 30% of its calories from protein. Vitamin B12 is another key thing that something like meat or other animal tissues can provide. Vitamin B12 is something that is really important. An absence of it can actually result in irreversible neurological problems. And you might not know that you're low in B12 for quite a period of time and might actually be starting to notice these deficiency symptoms, which are irreversible if you have a lack of vitamin B12. So meat is a great contributor, but not necessarily drastically more so than a lot of other food choices that are out there.
Do you remember what Eleanor said before? That Canadians eat about 0.5 pound of meat per day?
Overconsumption of meat can be associated with an overall dietary pattern that is harmful in the long term. So we would see it associated with increased risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes, even things like kidney troubles, potentially, especially if it's leading to the displacement or exclusion of fruits and vegetables, it can be associated with higher risk for cancer. Specific meats like cured meats like salami and those types of things in particular are associated with higher risks of cancer. So the overconsumption of meat can pose problems.
So we don't need it to be healthy. We abuse the animals that provide it, and we're eating so much of it that it's destroying the planet and our health. Why am I defending it? Why don't I just become a vegetarian? I just don't feel it's quite that simple. The more I learn about where our food comes from, the worse I feel about just about every food choice I make. The list of things to feel guilty about seems endless and ever-growing. We import food from miles away, we grow it with fertilizers that poison the earth, we package it, and then we throw that packaging in the landfill. And after all of this, we, as North Americans, we waste almost half the food we buy. While meat definitely sits on the top of that guilt list, I don't think cutting it out completely is the solution. I mean, there's a dark side to some vegetarian foods also. The soy that makes tofu is largely grown in genetically modified monocultures that threaten the Amazon rainforest. The rise in popularity of quinoa has driven up prices, devastating small-scale farmers who can't afford to eat their own crops. And then there's this.
Because it is quite a nutrient-dense food, if somebody's dietary intake is sort of just on the level of adequacy, or if they're perhaps not really eating a well-rounded diet overall, meat can make quite a significant contribution to helping them to meet some of their nutrient requirements. So to get that same kind of jump in getting closer to your nutrient requirements, you'd have to have a lot more grains and beans and vegetables to have that same impact that meat could on a diet that's barely nutritionally adequate.
Affording meat has always been a sign of wealth and privilege. But it's hard not to think that our ability to exclude it from our diets altogether comes from a place of privilege also. We have access to so much nutrition that we can remove this nutrient-rich, calorie-dense part of our diet and still remain healthy. My last reason for being pro-meat is the role that animals play in sustainable agriculture.
The animals are a really important part of the farm because they allow us to farm organically without using synthetic chemicals. For example, we have this noxious weed on our farm called quackgrass, and most people would spray with herbicides to get rid of it, like Roundup. But what we do is we bring in pigs in the spring, and they root it up and eat it and do a really good job. They don't really like the grass when it's long, though. So this year, we're going to be bringing in geese as well. So the geese will go ahead of the pigs and mow the grass, and then the pigs will come in and root it up. And I think that's going to work really well. So then we end up with these quack grass eating mowing machines that can also be food.
This is Julia Smith. She and her partner Ludo operate Urban Digs, a small-scale urban farm which grows market vegetables and raises livestock. I approached Julia to see if I could help with a rabbit slaughter. I felt for a long time that if I was going to keep eating meat, I had to be comfortable with killing an animal. But as I mentioned at the start, I had yet to do so. So I went out to the farm on a rainy afternoon to help Ludo with the rabbits.
I prefer doing rabbits than chickens, because chickens, my hands are too big.
Ludo is a giant, but he talks kindly to the rabbits before they're slaughtered. This is reassuring. I'm not sure if you can reassure a rabbit, but it reaffirmed for me how well these animals are treated.
What's this? Come on.
The rabbits are slaughtered using a .22 rifle. The bullet itself is tiny, about the size of a Tic Tac. It's one shot directly between the ears. Ludo does the first one to demonstrate, and then it's my turn.
Can we do some shooting, or?
Yeah, I'd like to. That's
okay. Okay, so just put it about right here and pull the trigger. Okay, so you're live.
Okay.
All right. So just follow just on top. Like this, go for it. Done. Good job.
And that's it.
So, it's dead. Like, it took a bullet in the brain. It's all, just like chickens, they squirm like this, but it's all nerves. Definitely dead. I know it's kind of, hard to watch, but they are. We find it's easiest and fastest way to do it. A lot of farmers break their necks. We don't want them to suffer.
I enter into a contract with my animals, and I agree to take care of them and give them the best life possible. And to me, that means seeing it through right to the very end. It's not pleasant, but, that's my end of the deal. So at the end of their life, we process them in a way that doesn't stress them at all. They have no idea what's coming. It's really only hard on us, right? A few days leading up to it, I know it's coming, and start to feel a little bit sad, but when slaughter day comes, I'm able to put my feelings aside. I have to put my feelings aside because that's what's best for the animal. People don't understand anymore how I can love my pigs and kill them.
It was easier than I had expected. I think that had a lot to do with Julia and Ludo. They've given these animals the best possible life and a clean, kind, quick death. They've come to terms with it, and they gave me the credit that I had come to terms with it myself. They weren't expecting me to be squeamish or sentimental, and so it was easy not to be.
People valued that meat because they'd raised it themselves, and it was so precious, and now you can just go and buy it in a styrofoam tray, and it's not special anymore.
What's a cow on the hoof worth? $1,500. Now, what happens is there's value in that animal. If that animal gets sick, it's to the rancher's interest that he pumps it full of antibiotics. The fatter, the bigger the animal, the more money he gets, so they pump them full of growth hormones. We fatten them up, pump them out, and then off they go to be slaughtered. When they have value, commercial value, then they look at contaminated meat. Well, maybe we can pass it through because we've got to make a buck on it. So what do you know about the animal you just ate?
And it's something that that we will continue to be supporting as long as we insist on having meat virtually every meal, and more importantly, as long as we insist that it be cheap. If the meat that you find at your local store is inexpensive, it was probably produced in a factory farm, and it probably came from animals that didn't have much of a life.
Take the corporate sponsors of the bill, and then you tie that into the products that they're making. So it's an app on your phone, so you scan an item like a barcode, and then it tells you if the company that made the product supported the bill.
This is Chris Durante. He's a friend who wrote a mobile application that challenged the anti-piracy laws going through Congress last year. Chris's project allows you to easily boycott the products of corporations who lobby for copyright control.
We wrote it in a couple hours, put it out on the internet, and it got like 30,000 downloads in a week before the bill got shelved, I guess. And a lot of press coverage. It's like we almost struck a nerve. People want more information about the items that they're consuming, whether it's related to something like online piracy censorship or if it's related to something else like an environmental or human rights issue that they care about.
But Chris's application only worked with one cause. What if you wanted to know more about the social and environmental impacts of the products and energy you consume every day? Where would you go? How would you find that information? Fair trade, organic, and other ethical certification labels are useful. However, they don't let you compare products and they're not transparent. Today, I'm going to discuss another method for discovering the environmental impacts of products, services, buildings, and energy. It's called life cycle assessment. I'll talk about life cycle assessment, LCA's, methods, its young history, its future prospects, and some of its findings generally, and here at UBC.
Let's begin.
But first, let me start with the context. When discussing climate change, there are three numbers I find compelling. The first is 2 degrees Celsius. That's the temperature rise that scientists tell us that we can allow before climate change will progress irreversibly. The second number is 565 gigatons of CO2. That's the amount we can emit before reaching that 2 degree threshold. The third number is 5 times that. Currently, energy industries have the legal right to extract and produce 5 times the allowable limit of carbon dioxide.
We don't have to guess about the direction we're taking. We know that if we keep emitting carbon dioxide in the air, you know, it's going to keep contributing to climate change. We know that if we keep on this path, there will be clear outcomes.
That voice? That was Rob Sianchuk. He's a professor of life cycle assessment here at the University of British Columbia and an environmental consultant here in Vancouver.
Life cycle assessment is a scientific method used to quantify the environmental impacts of products and services over their life cycle.
Long story short, life cycle assessment quantifies the materials and energy used in manufacturing to be then multiplied by environmental factors to estimate 8 different environmental impact indicators. So let's take a look at LCA's history. It turns out the method was pioneered by industry.
LCA started back in 1969. Coke was looking at switching from glass bottles to plastic bottles. What was driving the use of LCA back then was this increasing use of packaging waste and all these plastics and stuff. Tetra Pak was looking at using plastic, aluminum, and cardboard. And they were doing this study to figure out what the issues would be for incinerating this waste product. And in that study, they figured it would degrade the incinerator because of all the chlorine and the PVC in the plastic. And that chlorine would also contribute to acid rain.
In the 1970s, life cycle assessment shifted from packaging to energy use amid spiking oil prices, again looking to manufacture more efficiently. In those early days, industry embraced LCA for increases in their own efficiency and productivity, with emissions reductions as a side benefit. Today, with the rise of information, WikiLeaks, the internet, and consumer interest in the environment, corporations are increasingly doing life cycle assessment to clean up their manufacturing processes. They want to avoid a potential boycott enabled by an application such as Chris's.
If a company gets implicated in doing something bad for the environment, it's a PR disaster.
Walmart started their Sustainable Product Index in 2001, and that's where they started to survey all their suppliers, and ultimately what they wanted to develop was life cycle assessment databases on the products that they're selling.
So after 40 years of life cycle assessment, what have we found? I asked that question of Paul Tehan. Paul's a PhD researcher here at UBC. He looks at a particular group of consumer products, electronics. What are their emissions?
Usually it's like 20% better to do it electronically than to print it. Your laptops and your tablets, and your cell phones especially, are nothing compared to your desktops and your big televisions. The lighter your device, the less the footprint. I think over time, consumer devices are going to become less of a concern in this space, and the servers and network infrastructure is going to become more. Right now, they're sort of maybe vaguely equivalent in terms of energy and carbon footprint, I would guess. If you were to add them all up and look at your household personal carbon budget, I would guess it's in like the 3 to 5% range. People sometimes ask, what should I do? It's insulate your windows and turn down your thermostat.
So it turns out that things like consumer